greatest of the German idealists and the most influential philosopher of the 19th century was Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel. Okay. Hegel formulated a new philosophical language, and it's impossible to read him without it. We can only, as I mentioned, go through a bit of it here. Key among his terms is dialectic. Now, we already saw dialectic is an old word. It goes back to Plato, just meant the argument back and forth of philosophers. Dialectic in Kant meant something pejorative. It was when reason tries to know more than it can know, it runs into self-contradictions. Here, Hegel is using it in yet another form. Dialectic is the name Hegel gives to the manner of transition or development.
He's right, you know. Sometimes primitive force is the only way. Helps if there's some kind of legal reason behind it, of course, something outrageous to provoke spots.
Now, there's a famous way of describing this, namely, that all development of any kind, and this Hegel is indeed trying to apply this scheme of development to everything. In other words, to biological development, to the development of the universe, to the development of ideas about the universe, everything. Some people call this the theory of thesis, antithesis, synthesis. Those words were actually from Fichte, not Hegel. But they do capture the basic idea. The notion is dialectical development takes place where we begin with something or other, some entity or some position or idea, which, given the context in which it operates, naturally generates opposition or conflict with something else.
This
be a communist twat.
What happened?
Apparently a Dutch communist broke in and set the fire. Police have him under arrest.
Tell Rome he can still be of some service. You were talking about an enemies list. That's not a bad idea.
This is a signal from God. We are under siege. The terrorists have opened fire. And we will fire back. An outrageous crime. Someone will answer.
This completely overrides the Constitution. Effectively, it puts you in charge.
These are troubled times. The Constitution cannot anticipate them.
This conflict then eventually leads to a resolution, a transformation of the opposed elements to form a new unity, okay?
Hitler's just called an emergency meeting of the Reichstag. Wants their approval for something he calls the Enabling Act, which will turn this country into a police state with him as absolute ruler.
My God, no matter what he does, he just gets stronger.
I'll bet the Nazis set the fire themselves.
I am the Reichstag, the chance for peace in Germany.
Never. If you respect our country,
the Chancellor, please return to his seat.
I will take any refusal as a statement of opposition. Gentlemen, you must decide. Will it be peace or war?
It's in such dialectic that we find the creative advance of spirit and history to bridge or reincorporate differences at a higher level. That makes progress. So in effect, Hegel is giving a generalized theory of what he considers to be progress. If you want to see examples where you would get this, you would have to think in terms of, let's say, human beings or political movements who fight, and then decide, this is a very simplistic example, decide to settle their differences and unify into a larger community where everybody's rights are somehow respected under a different set of rules. In that case, there's been a conflict leading to integration at a higher level. It's the kind of thing Hegel was talking about. Anyway.
Deutschland, Deutschland, über alles,
Welcome back to the David Pakman Show.
Welcome back to the show.
Okay, Morality with Motomedy, Lewis, is turning into a huge cult hit. I'm getting way more ethical, moral dilemmas for Lewis to try to untangle for us. So here's the one for today, Lewis. Imagine you're placed in a room with Adolf Hitler when he's only 3 years old. Mm-hmm. Okay, you have a gun. You know exactly what he's going to do during World War II. You will not be charged in any way if you choose to kill him. But at the time, he's just an innocent little toddler.
Right.
Would you kill him? Is it morally justifiable knowing that he will be responsible for the deaths of millions? Do you kill Hitler?
Can't I just, like, cut out his tongue?
No. You could, but that's part of the question. Would you kill him or not? What would cutting out his tongue do?
I think that would pretty much put the kibosh on everything.
So you'd be fine with cutting out the tongue of a 3-year-old. Oh, yeah. Lewis is fine with just maiming and torturing. Oh, I'm sorry, enhanced way.
If it were to prevent the Holocaust, yeah, I would.
But you wouldn't kill him. By the way, you only have a gun.
I just don't think it would be necessary.
You only have a gun. You don't have a knife. You're in a room. You have
so
it's
I could
Hitler.
Just, like, shoot him through the jaw a few times from the side?
Wouldn't that kill a kid?
Depends on his health care plan, I guess.
We're going about this completely.
Do they have single-payer health care?
Did he at the time? You're adding in stuff that's from outside. The question
so
is...
So what? The premise is completely ridiculous.
No.
Why can't I add whatever I want?
The question tells us that he will go on to commit the atrocities if he lives. Just allow the question...
Oh, if he lives at all, he'll go on to commit the atrocities.
If he lives, he will commit the atrocities. And does not the murder of Adolf Hitler then become a moral obligation? His death would prevent the murder of millions, and Lewis is trying to figure out a way to just maim him? So would you kill Hitler or not?
Yeah, I guess I would.
You would do it?
Yep.
You know, I think I would too. I really do.
I would.
What do you think about this, Natan? I mean, can you shed some moral light onto this for us so we can figure out what the right... I believe that I think it would be justifiable to kill Hitler. We're, of course, assuming that we know... that it would be known without a doubt that what you prevented by doing it. I mean, there wouldn't be ambiguity there.
I mean, what makes you think that another German wouldn't come up, start the Nazi party, and do the exact same thing?
Motivations just simply are missed in most of academia. Why do we have war? Oh, it must be because nations want to steal from each other, utilitarian purposes. Every single theory that I've ever seen and studied in college of war says that it's called realism. Realism, that means that there's realistic reasons for going and taking something or other from somebody else or subjugating them. Wrong. Just simply historically wrong. I'll give a prize to anyone who shows me a major nation that went to war and got anything out of it. Do you really think that Adolf Hitler declared war against the 5 biggest countries in the world that were so much more huge and more powerful than him in order to get something? He did it because he was suicidal. The man was suicidal all his life, and Germany was suicidal at that time.
Da steht ein Soldat und hält Wacht, träumt von Hanne und dem Glück.
On the home front, the people of Germany are preparing for Christmas. Some of the families of soldiers trapped in Stalingrad have letters brought out by air. Private Werner Bunnemann.
My dear son, I hope that this is the last Christmas that you celebrate without me. The Russians have dealt us a nasty blow. It is now minus 30 degrees here. How nice it must be in warm rooms. Next year, I will hopefully be back with you. Love from your father, Werner.
Five weeks later, 90,000 surviving German soldiers in Stalingrad surrender. 80,000 will die in Soviet captivity. Private Werner Bunnemann is one of them. With Hitler's war claiming more and more German lives, even old men and boys are now called up to fight for the fatherland. The diary of 16-year-old Wolfgang Findesen.
Soldiers man these guns until now. Kids are taking over their job. It's very exciting. I like this much more than school.
As far as the dumbification of people, just in my biased view as a mathematician, kids are not taught how logic works in school. And the reason for that, I suppose we could speculate as to the conspiracies and what have you. But kids not being able to form paragraphs, kids not being able to perform mathematical functions, all of those kind of things are derived from the fact that they don't, at their core, understand the principles of logic.
So they're pretty much helpless, and like they're waiting to be told what to do. They're waiting to be given instructions at every step because they don't have a foundation of knowledge where they immediately, they have a process or they have a set of tools that allows them to confidently approach a new problem and say, well, I have to work out, I have to figure out how to do this based on simpler skills that I already know. And I run into this all the time on the SAT, which for the math is a very logic-based test. It's complex problem solving. It's using multiple concepts together. And kids are frustrated because they look at some of these problems and they say, I've never seen anything like this before. There's no way I could do this. I don't know what formula I would use. Find the area of a sector of a circle. No one ever gave me a formula for area of a sector of a circle. You know, so it's like they stall out right at the beginning because there's no one there telling them what to do. Now, this isn't all kids, but these are problems. I hate to say it, and I hate to talk about young people who I think are potentially brilliant. But when it comes to thinking, I run into this again and again, and I'm not like, it doesn't make me happy to mention this stuff, but it's true.
If I were a teacher, what I would be trying to convey to my students is I would try to take, for instance, a period in history and get them to think about what were the people at the time thinking that caused them to behave in the way that they did at that time. Maybe read, combine some of the literature that was written at that time, read that, and get a context for what was going on at the time and why things were happening the way they were happening. I don't think things like that they're just being taught dates and people who did certain things and factoids, like you said. Yeah. There are things like that, and that goes into critical thinking and being able to apply something, the idea that if we fail to learn from history, we're condemned to repeat it, things like that. I would be curious, for instance, if someone talks about Anne Frank, and if a teacher ever gets someone to consider, can you imagine a case where your government might be doing something corrupt and you would be actually protecting a fugitive from government?
Sure.
And might that be the moral thing to do? But can you imagine a modern school teaching even breaching such a subject?
I think it would reveal, like, understanding, like, what are the motivations? What is the zeitgeist at the time? What are people feeling? What were they thinking? What were they being told? What ideologies were they embracing? I think that's all very, very dangerous territory for government school because it could reveal a lot of the under-the-surface corruption, you know, the philosophic corruption of society. Like, why do people support slavery? Why do people accept war? What was the situation in Germany? How did they go for all of that? And if you understand what was underneath and how much of that translates directly into our society, into our thinking today, it's just very dangerous. So instead of, you know, looking at the gasoline-soaked house, because so much of history is bad news, right? And a lot of, like, it's the spotlight on bad people doing horrific things while good people stand by and do nothing or cheer them on. So in the case of, like, these wars in the first half of the 20th century, it's like this tossing of matches onto a gasoline-soaked house. And then they step back and they say, well, clearly this house reduced to a pile of ashes was caused by three matches. You know, and that's not what reduced
right.
the house. But we talk about the economic system in Germany, the rhetorical skills of Adolf Hitler. The gasoline-soaked house was their ideology, was their education system. So if you learn about World War I in school, you would think it was when some Serbian assassinated Archduke Ferdinand, and this started a war. I mean, and you know so little about causal relationships that this makes sense. That goes back to what Osborne was saying about logic, that immediately someone would say, stop. The fact that such a small event, the assassination of an Austrian nobleman, could start one of the most ghastly, destructive, horrific wars in history. Like, something is missing there. You know what I mean? So, like, that's a match. You know, where, let's look at, like, the explosives and the gasoline and the incendiaries and the accelerants. All that stuff is missing. All that is missing from the
context. It's really a lot. Again, it's context and critical thinking and analysis of what exactly was going on and why did that match set off a huge fire?
But they can't know that because then I think they'd very easily be able to make connections between then and now and say, wait a minute, we still believe that.
Yeah.
This is Liberty Conspiracy Live, 603-499-PORC. We're doing a little school edition, and we're also talking about movies and rabbits, and you can call in and bring up whatever you like. 603-499-PORC, Skype in your head shows.
This is really the greatest country in the whole world. All the other countries suck. And if this country ever goes to war, as it often wants to do, I promise to help go and kill all the other country's kids. God bless GE. God bless Citigroup. Amen.
Very good, kids. Now come and get your Ritalin.
The purpose of the show today is to provide some context for a video that I recently put out on YouTube called The American Way. Here's why I'm doing this. Just by looking at downloads, I can tell that it brought quite a few new people into listening to the show. So I certainly understand if you're new that you're listening with a guarded enthusiasm or even a skepticism, and I think that's great, and I hope you maintain that. But I think it's my responsibility to provide some more information about a video that really just skips across the surface of some very deep and complex issues. And that's what I want to try and do today. So I want to start out. Well, what you're going to hear, first of all, is a compilation of some audio that I haven't released yet. Two are interviews that I did on other people's shows, one with Lorette Lynn and one on a show called Live Free FM. Oh, and also a clip that I cut out of the Logical Fallacies intro with Richard Grove and Tony Myers, just because it was kind of it was off track from what we were talking about, and I wanted to keep that show as focused as possible. So, but I didn't want to lose that material, so I think I found a way to include it in the show. And our goal is to provide a fuller picture. And hopefully, if you know, you have showed the video to other people, shared the video with other people, and they had some questions like, yeah, what about this? That's also great. And I hope that this show provides some more information if there is any discussion, or if the video or videos like it, or the work of Jonathan Taylor Gatto. I mean, maybe you went and you watched The Ultimate History Lesson, or maybe you heard me mention, or will in the future act on my mention of his book, The Underground History of American Education. And you want to take this story of the Prussian roots of American education to other people and the consequences that they ultimately had in Germany in the 1930s and the 1940s. I'm hoping that I can give you a little bit more ammo to do that in today's show. So I'm going to start just to set the stage with this discussion that I had with Lorette. This is just a clip from that, and that will open it up to all these different areas that we can explore. This is a long one. I hope you like a long show. I know the last couple have been long. This one will also be, you know, long. So here we go.
You put together a video that is on YouTube right now that when I saw it, I was thoroughly impressed. I thought it was extremely well done. It wasn't long. It wasn't drawn out. There weren't a lot of excessive details. It was very easy to follow, but very wisely done. So tell us a little bit more about that for anybody that hasn't already seen it. What motivated you to do it, and exactly what is the point of it?
Well, sure. I mean, the point of it is nothing more than an introduction, because we're talking about the American Way was a video that I made kind of paralleling the rise of socialism, imperialism, and eventually, you know, fascism and the Third Reich in Germany over the course of 100 years with what has happened in the United States, really focusing on the last couple decades in the United States, but something that's been going on here since the school system was introduced. Now, the problem with the video is that it's simplistic, right? So school is one factor that has contributed to what are very complex problems. I mean, if we look at the history of the Prussian Kingdom into the Weimar Republic, into the Third Reich, there's a myriad of factors that contribute to that. One of the things that we touched on in this show was philosophy. You had a turn of phrase about a minute ago where you said something like something becomes this becomes something out of nothing for no reason. You know, like this just comes to be and then all people accept it.
Yeah, well, it becomes a thing.
Yeah, it becomes a thing for no reason. Well, that's a pretty accurate synopsis of German idealism. It starts with this guy named Kant who just says, we can't really know anything. So, and then his disciples, his students, who are not philosophers but mystics, people like Johann Fichte, just kind of run with that idea. And you invent this idea of collectivism, or not, maybe they didn't invent it, but they certainly give it a new kind of twist. And ultimately that results in Nietzsche, who's somebody who's different from the rest of them. And he's like, you know, Kant's the beginning of the 1800s. Nietzsche's the end of the 1800s, but Nietzsche has this idea of Superman, that disaster and destruction of the masses of ordinary people is a small price to pay. And I think his ideas were perverted. I don't think he was like saying, yeah, we need a Hitler. But Hitler looked at that philosophy and said, yeah, that's me. We're the Supermen. And was able to pervert that into his own, into a justification for his own political goals. So philosophy, and that again is just skipping across the surface of 100 years of German thought, but that's a factor too. Obviously, economics is a huge factor in people's desperation that led to them accepting somebody like Hitler, because he promised that he could fix those things, that he could change those things. And he was a very, very effective rhetorician. And because of their schooling, they were prey for that. That was an easy thing for them to go for. But they were already, you know, forced into this non-logical thinking and very emotional, very fearful thinking because of the condition that Germany was in after World War One. And imperialism is another factor that greatly contributes to the rise of the Third Reich in Nazi Germany. With, Germany has these imperial ambitions at the end of the 1800s. It's partially a result of their culture, which is partially a result of their school system. But I think they're also, you know, the leadership of the country is also looking at places like England and France and saying, well, we better get organized here, you know, because they're trying to grow, and eventually, you know, people are going to start bumping into each other and somebody's going to have to contract. I mean, that's pretty much how imperialism works. So I'm not saying that they were justified in what they did, with their imperial ambitions, but obviously you could make the case that it was at least to some degree defensive. So we have international relations, we have economics, we have philosophy, and we have education. And I probably left a few things out that are relatively important. But what happened in Germany between 1850 and 1945 is an incredibly complex story that it would take, books to tell in sufficient detail.
Well, the bulk of it is, and the point that I thought you made brilliantly in the video is that almost like a warning, like you were giving humanity a warning that we're, especially in this country, we are headed in the same direction.
We're
and
there.
We need to recognize the similarities between what is happening with us today through our schooling system and what has happened then. And you were able to really illustrate the similarities between those tactics and the tactics that are being implied today.
There's been hints of this in the United States going back 100 years. I mean, Joseph Goebbels, who was the Nazi minister of propaganda, idolized Franklin Roosevelt. He thought he was a genius. He's like, wow, look at this guy just invent the legend of himself in the moment.
you know, with the way he managed the Great Depression and the way he introduces the New Deal and the way he uses newsreels, the March of Time, or not the March of Time, because I think that had more to do with war, but the way he uses newsreels to, like, glamorize the policies of his administrations. Goebbels credits Roosevelt and the New Deal as, you know, an inspiration for a lot of the things that he did in the 30s and in the 40s as well. Roosevelt had camps for people. This is not a warning. This has been going on here in a variety of different forms, assaults on freedom. I mean, we can go back to World War I and talk about the Espionage Act of Woodrow Wilson, where people could be thrown in jail for criticizing the policies of the government. And I'm not saying that Woodrow Wilson is any worse than what's going on today, but that certainly at the time should have been a very sort of shocking development for a lot of people. The idea of going to a foreign war was not like, well, should we or shouldn't we? At first it was right. Like, what are you even talking about?
In right. Fact, it was a time when we Congress had to decide on that.
And, yeah. And Wilson, even prior to World War I, Wilson had to keep, I mean, he was a hardcore imperialist, and he had to keep most of his interventions in Cuba and Mexico and Central America relatively hush-hush. It's very difficult to make, like, real objective judgments as far as, like, are things worse now or then? Is the United States worse than Germany in 1940 or not? But obviously, I think that history does, to a certain extent, follow patterns. I was criticized significantly for the simplification and kind of trying to what appears to be in the video a blaming all of what's going on the education system. For me, I think it is the most important aspect of all of that. But it's not to say that there aren't all other factors that contribute to the current situation in the United States and what ultimately happened in Germany in the 1940s.
Well, you know what, Brett? There certainly are other factors. But if we are going to look for the actual culprit, the actual root, and this is something that needs to happen in all areas when we think about things critically, like when you're sick, to just take a pill and make it go away, that's wrong, because we're not looking for the root. We're not looking for the cause. We're just treating the symptoms. So while there are other influences and there are other factors that contribute to the problems that we're seeing, if we are to identify the root, and there is always there is a root, okay? And if we are to identify the root, then it has to be the way in which information is put into us. Okay, the way that we are educated, the way that we are molded. Yes, we're influenced by media. Yes, we're influenced by advertising. Yes, we're influenced by our skewed version of history. And we're influenced by a whole bunch of different factors and political push and fear tactics and everything else. But the fact of the matter is that when you take a child, when you take most of society and you start at the time that they're children, infants, 3-4 years old, and you start to make them believe certain things in dogmatic ways, and you feed them certain information and skewed versions of information, that really is the root, because that controls how they behave. That controls not only, you're not giving them the decisions to make, okay? People don't graduate from high school and, you know, I'm going to make this decision because I was told to make this decision. They think they're making their own decision. They think that they're thinking
That's
freely.
True. Yep.
But it's all based on the influence that they've had. The reason why we're so susceptible to all these other influences, yes, we're influenced in many different ways, but the reason we're so susceptible and so vulnerable to all that influence is because we've been trained to be vulnerable to it. So if we're going to identify a root, then I agree with you. It is the way in which we are trained and we are conditioned in the school system.
So today on the show, I think that the most important place to start is with ideas. So you heard me mention Kant, Hegel, Fichte, and Nietzsche in my discussion with Laurette Lynn. But I also, before we even get started with that, I just want to introduce a book that might be worth checking out if you're interested in learning a lot more about this subject. It's not a primary source, but it's certainly an interesting read. It's by a man named Leonard Peikoff, who was Ayn Rand's intellectual heir. And I don't love this guy, I'll tell you that right now, but he has done some good work. He's a little dogmatic in his whole followership of Ayn Rand, but He wrote a book in the 1980s called The Ominous Parallels. And I just want to read you a quick review of that, just so you can see that these are not, you know, new ideas in the 21st century. This is a warning that has been coming for quite some time, especially from the rationalist objectivist. So, The Ominous Parallels by Leonard Peikoff. Each of the philosophic principles essential to the rise of Nazism in Germany has a counterpart in present-day America. Is the freest country on earth moving towards totalitarian dictatorship? What, imagine how radical this was in the 1980s. Jeez. What are the factors that enabled the Nazis to seize power in pre-war Germany? Do those same conditions exist in America today? These are the questions raised and answered with frightening clarity by Leonard Peikoff, Ayn Rand's intellectual heir, in his powerful book, The Ominous Parallels. We are drifting to the future, but not moving purposefully, Peikoff warns. We are drifting as Germany moved, in the same direction for the same kind of reason. Some of the ominous parallels between pre-Hitler Germany and the United States that Peikoff identifies. Now remember, at the time, this a lot of these things had less palpability, you know, in our political reality than they do today. So this is pretty astute that he was able to point them out in such detail. Number one, liberals who demand public control over the use and disposal of private property, Social Security, more taxes, more government, control over the energy industry, medicine, broadcasting, etc. And of course, if the internet had existed then, you could add that to this list in all capital letters, bold-faced, italic, underlined. Two, conservatives who demand government control over our intellectual and moral life. Prayer in the schools, literary censorship, government intervention in the teaching of biology, and you could add history to that, the anti-abortion movement, etc. Three, political parties devoid of principles or direction and moved at random by pressure groups, each demanding still more controls. Four, a progressive anti-intellectual educational system that from kindergarten to graduate school creates students who can't read or write. Students brainwashed into feeling that their minds are helpless and they must adapt to quote-unquote society, that there is no absolute truth and that morality is whatever society says it is. Five, this one is interesting, a student radical movement from the 1960s through the violent anti-nukers and ecology fanatics of today, who are, Peikoff maintains, the quote pre-Hitler youth movement resurrected. These radicals are nature worshippers who attack the middle class, science, technology, and business. Number six, the rise of defiant old world racial hatreds disguised as ethnic identity movements and affirmative action. Seven, a pervasive atmosphere of decadence, moral bankruptcy, and nihilist art accompanied by the rise of escapic mystic cults of every kind. And Peikoff's list here is astrology, alternative medicine, in quotes. I think that that's something that maybe is not as controversial today. I mean, I would consider alternative medicine anything that doesn't involve being prescribed drugs for some kind of ailment, and I put a lot of, you know, personal stock in that idea. And that even, for me, that even would come down to, you know, diet. You know, like, how are you feeling? What are you eating? And then the Orientalist extrasensory perception, etc. That's what he adds to the list. So, in brilliantly reasoned prose, Peikoff argues that the deepest roots of German Nazism lie not in existential crises, but in ideas. Not in Germany's military defeat in World War I, or the economic disasters of the Weimar Republic that followed, but the philosophy that dominated pre-Nazi Germany. Although it was mediated by crises, Peikoff demonstrates that German Nazism was the inevitable climax of a centuries-long philosophic development, preaching three fundamental ideas: the worship of unreason, the demand for self-sacrifice, and the elevation of society or the state above the individual. These ideas, Peikoff says, are the essence of Nazism, and they are exactly what our leading universities are now spreading throughout this country. This is the basic cause of all the other parallels. So let's start today with ideas. As we jump abruptly from Leonard Peikoff, the objectivist. And before we do that, let's just give objectivism a definition. Here are the central tenets of objectivism. Number one, reality exists as an objective absolute. Facts are facts independent of man's feelings, wishes, hopes, or fear. Two, reason, the faculty which identifies and integrates the material provided by man's senses, is man's only means of perceiving reality, his only source of knowledge, his only guide to action, and the basic means of survival. Three, man, every man, is an end in himself, not the means or the ends of others. He must exist for his own sake, neither sacrificing himself to others nor sacrificing others to himself. The pursuit of his own rational self-interest and his own happiness is the highest moral purpose in his life. Four, the ideal political economic system is laissez-faire. All right, let's skip that one because this is kind of where Ayn Rand blew it. She wasn't consistent there with politics. But those first three, I mean, that's a good introduction to objectivism. So now we jump to, I'll call him the anti-objectivist, the 18th and 19th century philosopher Immanuel Kant.
How would you recommend someone to go about reading authors such as Kant, Hegel, Aristotle, etc., which for various reasons are difficult to read? Well, almost all major philosophers are difficult to read, especially Greek and German philosophers. I won't discuss why that is, but first of all, read a simple summary for beginners of the philosophy and read that in advance. And when you think you have a general orientation, get some one excellent commentator. For example, if you're reading Kant's Critique, there's a two-volume commentary by Paton, P-A-T-O-N. And what I did, I put the commentary on one side of the desk and the book on the other, and read a sentence or two, say, from the Critique. And I have an idea what it means, but I'm not sure. And then I read the passage from Paton on those sentences, and then I go back, and after a while I get the idea, and you shuttle back and forth, and every once in a while you stop, you try to sum up, you know, reduce the units, keep getting in your mind a growing idea of what is essential, and then when you think you have a much better idea, read more advanced presentations and see whether they jibe with what you've read. It's tremendously difficult. I think I spent full time, 5 months, reading the Critique of Pure Reason. It was a nightmare. I don't think anybody should do it unless, you know, you absolutely have to earn a living.
Now, Immanuel Kant, in a very, very small nutshell, is the idea that perception is reality. Reality is not objective. It does not exist outside of the human mind, right? Perception is reality. Compare that to what Leonard Peikoff just said. People believe that morality is whatever society says it is. Kant is a very, very important philosophic root. This is basically the beginning of what is called German idealism. Now, for our purposes here, and considering the wide scope of material that I want to try and cover in this show, I'm going to try to be as simple as possible. If you feel this is an oversimplification, do not write to me. Please post it on the School Sucks Facebook page. Very soon we will have groups and forums and on the new website, and you can put this stuff there, but for now, do not write to me and wait for me to address it or correct it on the show. Put it somewhere where everyone can see it and we can deal with it there. So in the late 1700s, Kant wrote a book called The Critique of Pure Reason, where he categorized judgments, ideas, statements into two groups. The first one, analytic. An analytic judgment is something like a self-validating statement. All black houses are houses. right? The truth of that statement is contained, like, if it's a black house, then it's a house. Okay, so that is called an analytic judgment. This is also a priori, Latin for before. In other words, you don't need to actually go through an empirical process to determine this. The truth is within the statement. If you know what black is and you know what a house is, you can arrive at this conclusion. The other type of judgment was called synthetic, a judgment that has to be made a posteriori or after. For example, the house is black. You have to observe the house itself to know that that's the truth. But Kant also has this fascination, maybe even a small obsession with what lies beyond. In his writing, he refers to this as the noumenal world, N-O-U-M-E-N-A-L. Okay, now, even though he has this process of organizing judgments before and after, analytic and synthetic, he also wants to do this exploration of what else. So we can imagine this like there's two columns, right? There are the analytic judgments, the validating through the statement itself. All black houses are houses. And there's the synthetic judgment. The house is black, which requires observation. So the best way that I can sum this up is that what Kant is interested in is a synthetic a priori judgment. So synthetic, requiring observation, but a priori, you do not have to see to know this. And this is not complete madness, okay, because he uses mathematics as an example. 2 + 2 = 4 is considered to be a universal truth. But in his reasoning, that's not analytic, right? Because when we said all black houses are houses, there is information in the premise about the conclusion, but there's no information, simply put, about 4 in 2. Or we can do 3 + 1. There is no information about 4 in 3 or 1. So this was an example. Mathematics is an example of a synthetic a priori judgment. Now, in my opinion, this is shit, okay? Frankly, because I'm not an expert on Kant, but did he ever address the criticism, or was he ever confronted with the question about the empiricism involved in mathematics? That most of the things today that we understand to be universally true in mathematics were eventually brought to our awareness, if we go back far enough in the past, through some kind of empirical process, through some kind of inductive method. Again, look, I don't want to get that into Kant. We could get way into Kant. We could talk about him for an hour and a half, 10 hours, 100 hours. But I don't want to. And honestly, for our purposes here, it's not that important, because all I want to do is establish some groundwork for how some of his ideas were at the foundation of German idealism. And first of all, because of this synthetic a priori, two things come into question: empiricism and reason. Because through Kant's work, and especially his early work, this Critique of Pure Reason, we have the idea that knowledge cannot come from sensory experience alone. So very, very serious questions about empiricism. And that we cannot comprehend things through reason alone. So very, very serious questions about reason. Now, little door, big door, actually, swings open here. Okay, because if we're not going to rely on reason and empiricism, you know what's going to happen. And it's interesting here. It's interesting. This is the beginning of the 1800s, but Kant also has this, what seems like a pretty innocuous contribution to ethics. It's called the categorical imperative. In a nutshell, what is the categorical imperative? Well, it is the idea that your behavior, you should behave as if it creates a universal law for all people. Unconditional command of our conscience to act, quote, as if the maxim of our action were to become our will, a universal law of nature. So in other words, an action is moral if it is desirable. Subjectively, an action is moral if it is desirable, another subjective word, that it become a universal not subjective, rule of behavior. Okay. If you're a nonviolent, non-psychopathic, non-power-hungry person, you might hear that and think, oh, yeah, that's kind of like the golden rule. That's not a bad idea. But on the other hand, if you are a violent, psychopathic, power-hungry person, you might be fiddling with your little pointy beard and saying, that's the ticket, right? Because, well, that our behavior should be translatable to universal rules. Who's making rules? Who can really use that? And what can that really mean? And do we eventually see the growth of the idea of the general will, which is Hegel, which we'll get to, grow out of this, where the general will is really just a euphemism for the will of those in power? And Kant, I don't know if he knew what he was doing or if this was just pure accident. It's funny, too, because his whole thing with ethics was that what should really matter is what your intentions were, right? The consequences shouldn't be, we shouldn't be using consequences of actions, like in the real world, what he called the phenomenal world, the world that we actually live in, versus the noumenal world. But goodwill is what matters, not consequences. So what's also related to Kant's ethical theory is something called the ethics of duty. And this essentially is the concept, simply put. It's more complex than this, but we got to get off Kant. We got to get away from this guy. Self-sacrifice. The virtue of self-sacrifice. And this is why I asked the question, did he know what he was doing? Right? Because he says in his own writing, well, if we evaluate ethics just based on the consequences of actions, we have to recognize that sometimes people set out to do good things and bad things happen. So we should just evaluate based on the will, the idea. What were they trying to do? Okay, so who does that excuse? It certainly excuses Kant, because what we're looking at here, first of all, this downgrading, this dismissal, or certainly minimization of the importance of the physical, the objective world as just this facade, you know, that what really matters is this noumenal world that we can only understand through faith, not reason. By the way, here's your ethics. If what is good or what you do, it should be universalizable. How easily does that become, we should all be doing the same thing? And who is the one who determines what the right thing to do is? So what do we get from Kant before we move on? Regardless of what he was trying to do, right? I'm sure he would love if he could be reanimated and watch how his ideas played out through the 1800s and the 1900s, he would certainly be saying, yeah, but look at my intentions. And of course, his ideas could have been perverted by the philosophers and the personalities in power that followed. And they were, to some extent, for sure. But this is definitely the groundwork. So what is it? Well, it's the abandoning of reason. And it is also this sort of altruistic collectivism, the ethics of duty. And that reminds me of a quote. It's right at the beginning of that book that I was telling you about, The Ominous Parallels by Leonard Peikoff. Quote, "It is thus necessary that the individual should finally come to realize that his own ego is of no importance in comparison with the existence of his nation, that the position of the individual ego is conditioned solely by the interests of a nation as a whole, that above all, the unity of a nation's spirit and will are worth far more than the freedom of the spirit and will of an individual. This state of mind, which subordinates the interests of the ego to the conservation of the community, is really the first premise for every truly humane culture. The basic attitude from which such activity arises, we call to distinguish it from egoism and selfish idealism. By this, we understand only the individual's capacity to make sacrifices for the community, for his fellow men." Unquote.
Peikoff then says, these statements were made in our century by the leader of a major Western nation. His countrymen regarded his viewpoint as uncontroversial. His political program implemented it faithfully. The statements were made by Adolf Hitler, and he was explaining the moral philosophy of Nazism. So very, very dangerous seeds planted in the late 1700s and the early 1800s by Immanuel Kant. So, who is watering these seeds? Well, first and foremost, a man named Johann Gottlieb Fichte. And as you already know, because you've heard his name on this show several times in the past, he also later will put himself in charge of pest control to protect what those seeds are growing from any annoying disturbances. Boy, getting a little heavy with the metaphors here. Anyway, Fichte lives around the same time as Kant. You know, and he is a big admirer of Kant. He says, oh, I like that guy. I want to be near that guy. He didn't speak English. I made that up. But that's kind of, I mean, that's a good encapsulation of how he felt about Kant. Now, it's interesting how he gains notoriety in the philosophical community. He writes a book trying to imitate the style of Kant, which is very difficult to do because it's very, very difficult to read Immanuel Kant. But he does it successfully, and a book is published without a name on it, and everybody assumes, once it starts to circulate, that it was written by Kant himself. But it was written by Fichte. And people are so impressed by this that he is able to make a household name for himself very, very quickly, imitating Kant's style, and of course, to a large degree, Kant's philosophy. But there is a problem. One thing that Fichte cannot reconcile with Kant's views is the idea that reality will forever remain unknowable. So, this is what he does. I'm not making this up. He states that not only is he, so going back to the idea kind of Descartes that I think, therefore I am, but it's more like my understanding of it from what I've read is I think, so everything is. In other words, I'm not my own creation. The world is my creation. So that's Fichte in a peanut shell. Now, from what I can tell, Fichte is insane. Because he's clearly very smart. You know, if he understands Kant and he can write in that style, clearly there's some intelligence there. But he doesn't use it to iron out some of the glaring contradictions in Kant's work. He says, ooh, contradictions. Let's expand on those. And really just goes nuts. One of his students was another German philosopher named Arthur Schopenhauer. And I'm actually going to take this from the Wikipedia page, which is short, but it has some good details. This is Schopenhauer's criticism. Fichte, who because of the thing in itself had just been discredited, at once prepared a system without any thing in itself. Consequently, he rejected the assumption of anything that was not through and through merely our representation. And therefore, let the knowing subject be all in all, or at any rate produce everything from its own resources. For this purpose, he at once did away with the essential and most meritorious part of the Kantian doctrine, the distinction between a priori and a posteriori, and thus that between the phenomenon and the thing in itself. For he declared everything to be a priori, naturally without any evidence for such a monstrous assertion. Instead of these, he gave sophisms and even crazy sham demonstrations whose absurdity was concealed under the mask of profundity and the incomprehensibility ostensibly arising therefrom. Moreover, he appealed boldly and openly to intellectual intuition, that is, really, to inspiration. The first time I ever talked about Johann Fichte, or Jörg Hegel, in my podcast, it was episode 25. It's called The Way. And I used a term that I think I was borrowing from a book, intellectual fashion. Here's a clip of old me.
It seems increasingly irrelevant today in a world of globalization and internationalization. But some politicians, threatened with the need to pool their power, have rediscovered a certain nostalgia for the nation state. And before I put the book away, why don't we flip ahead a few dozen pages to page 328 to see where this kind of mystical idea eventually leads. This is called Master Race, the idea of German superiority. In the opening years of the 19th century, Germany was a stomping ground for the French and Russian armies. This humiliating experience provoked an intensely nationalist reaction, an attempt to show that, like all history's best victims, Germans were really superior to their conquerors. Germany, in many Germans' opinion, needed to unite and organize for resistance and counterattack. Meanwhile, inspired by Plato's theory of forms, German philosophers saw the Volk, German for people, as an ideal, a transcendent, immutable reality. The first rector of the University of Berlin, Johann Gottlieb Fichte, thought German identity was eternal and unchanging. To have character and be German were undoubtedly the same thing. That's a quote. The Volkgeist, the spirit of the nation, was essentially good and insuperably civilizing. Hegel thought that the Germans had replaced the Greeks and Romans as the final phase in the, quote, historical development of spirit. That sounds kind of familiar. Last best hope. Quote, the German spirit is the spirit of the new world. Its aim is the realization of absolute truth as the unlimited self-determination of freedom. Unquote. Weird. This sounds very grand and a bit scary. There was no good reason behind it except for intellectual fashion.
So, I gave you the Schopenhauer quote. I gave you an explanation before of essentially the world is my own creation. But simply put, it's this. Boy, I just noticed something. Because of my schooling, my upbringing, my class, when I talk to like ordinary folks, I sound way smarter than them. So what I should do is just make a bunch of shit up that serves my purposes or the purposes of those in power that I'm trying to please. And probably, as long as I do enough acrobatics, nobody will even notice. I'm going to try that. Now, of course, Fichte did not invent this, and you can see that it's still very popular today. We can also see that it's no coincidence that somebody who thought that they could get away with this kind of sophistry would also be so important, so influential in the development of a schooling system. A scientific management of human beings system that we are all still forced into today. But Fichte's contributions to Prussian society are not simply educational. He's also, as you can tell from the clip from my old show that I played, he's into this idea of nationalism because, you know, if the reins are off, if the leash is off when it comes to reason and empiricism, why not? Let's make up nationalism. Now, of course, nationalism, not a German invention, not a Prussian invention, just like the way Fichte is going to sell it or accelerate it is not new at this time. But everything gets a push through his ideology. So nationalism is very important, people bonding around an ethnic identity. But there has to be outsiders in that. Like there's got to be a loser. So what had been growing slowly since probably about the 1500s in the German states. Now remember, there is no unified Germany at this point, and Prussia is just one independent kingdom of many that was once referred to as the Holy Roman Empire and then eventually consolidated into a unified Germany under Otto von Bismarck. Oh, I'm getting ahead of myself. We're going to get there. But anyway, at this point, nationalism is accelerated
you know, this idea of German identity, even though there is not a geopolitical unity. In fact, there's actually quite a bit of geopolitical tension throughout the 1700s and 1800s in this region of the world in Central Europe. But the bad guy is the Jews. Yep. So this is really the acceleration of anti-Semitism, too, in a big way. And Fichte refers to the Jews as a state within a state, a real threat. We see how this is part of the effort to strengthen the mythology of nationalism today, right? You can start with an external threat, which is very useful in getting people to bond together, of course, under their rulers. Sooner or later, you need to start talking about some kind of internal threat as well if you want to keep that going. And really what's implied in that, because this is obviously a racist idea, is there has to be some kind of ethnic or racial difference that is, there's undertones of that, right? You never just say, oh, you know, we hate them because they're Mexicans, right? But I mean, that's implied in all of the rhetoric against illegal immigration. You know, it's the subtext. Today, anyway, and you really didn't have to do it that much then. Like, you could just say stuff then and it would be okay. I mean, Fichte said, the Jews are a state within a state. They're dangerous. And if we allow them to become citizens of our nation, it's going to undermine the nation. And, you know, like I talked about in recent shows, horrendous lies can ride on the truth. And sometimes those truths are small and even insignificant in the context of the bigger picture, in the context of the lie they're ultimately used to create. You know, when you're trying to build a strong ethnic identity to establish national unity, maybe just for the purpose, aside from the wonderful dividends paid in controlling a population, you know, they are also at this time, the time of Fichte, Napoleon is around, and they're trying to protect the Prussian kingdom from French incursions. So this is the rationalization for a lot of this kind of thinking, or a lot of the action that is the result of this kind of thinking. But at this time, with this effort to build national unity, or to at least establish an ideological foundation for a national unity, there are clearly outsiders. Because what is true about, you know, the Jewish communities is that they are relatively tight-knit in Germany at this time. And it's also true that throughout the 1900s and, or the 1800s and the 1900s, that if you look at the people who are in positions of power in international banking and finance, disproportionately, they are Jewish. That's not a controversial statement at all. In a very broader historical sense, it is true that obviously the Jews have been forced time and again to disperse and displace. So in the 1800s, in the time of Fichte, or even in the 1900s, in the time of the Nazis, Jews live in several different countries. And this is not consistent with the idea, this noble idea of nationalism. And this is like one of Hitler's arguments eventually, that these Jews are everywhere, he says. They go and do business all over the world. They live here, they live there. And how can you trust people like that? Like, we're trustworthy because we're German. We're attached to this soil. Now, aside from all the mysticism and insanity in that statement, what Hitler is saying is that the Jews don't have a state. Which is true. They don't have a state. Now, lateral to this, one thing that Hitler makes like a big virtue is loyalty. Because as what they're doing, especially into the 40s, becomes more visible, you have to shift away from what he said, that statement that I read out of the Peikoff book at the beginning of the show. Well, you have to shift away from some of your older moral arguments, because now some of that stuff, if you look at the horror show going on in Germany, especially by the time they're setting up these camps, that really doesn't stand anymore. Now the virtue is loyalty. But this is not just loyalty to him, because that's not, he doesn't say the problem with the Jews is that they won't be loyal to me, Adolf Hitler. No, they won't be loyal to this whole bigger picture, because at this point, the leadership or the rulers, the state, the landmass, and the people,
in the minds of the German people, all those things have coalesced into one entity, the Fatherland. Geez, can you even imagine being surrounded by such mystics?
But now let's leap back in time to Fichte, who, like I said, views the Jews as a state within a state, outsiders.
And the reason why I bring this up is I don't want it to be just completely silly sounding, like, oh, let's blame the Jews for no reason. There was no real reason, but they made a reason out of, that was loosely based on reality at the time, that these people have tight-knit communities and these people work in banking and finance, and that was manipulated into a crisis.
And if you look at how easy it was for this to all go down here, with Muslims, with Mexicans, based on the fact that there might be some bad people in each of those groups. I mean, all they would need to do, I think, at that time in Germany, where people are so miseducated, they believe in this idea of collective identity, and probably, considering how militaristic the culture is, they were all ready to hate somebody. All you'd really have to do in like the mid-1800s, late-1800s, early-1900s, is tell them about the Rothschilds. They're German. They're Jews. They're bankers. And they're bad. Those are facts. Right? But you could see how that could be spun into all Jews are like, the Rothschilds. That's not true. That's not accurate. But that could be done considering the conditions there at that time. And then the whole no loyalty to any noble nation state thing was added as an accelerant, I believe, later on.
And that crisis obviously, or the illusion of that crisis grew throughout the 1800s and the 1900s. This was used. And if I just say, oh, yeah, well, he made up this thing that the Jews are bad. Well, that kind of separates it a little bit too much from the reality of today, because we see that there is at least motivations for the things that our government is doing. It's not just saying, ta-da, Patriot Act, ta-da, NDAA. They're trying to come up with rationalizations for why they do these things, to prevent a complete insurrection here, if that's even possible. Not that it's recommended, but yeah, I just want to make sure that we understand that they're using a lot of the same techniques of taking little, perhaps even inconsequential truths and using them as building blocks for some enormous lie. This is going on all the way back in the beginning of the 1800s. By the time it gets to Hitler, I think the thinking at that time is like, well, if we can build big lies out of little truths, why can't we just build big lies out of little lies? And after, 4 or 5 generations of the school system, well, surprise, that actually works.
So I think at this point we can move beyond Fichte and Kant. We can move beyond the arguments against reason, even though there are more coming in the future. And this is the soil. This is the very fertile soil. These ideologies for the expansion of nationalism, ethnocentrism, anti-Semitism, collectivism. But now I would like to synthesize these arguments against reason with the ultimate argument from authority, Jörg Hegel. Here are a couple of his quotes. Now, this is not an encapsulation. This is just to set the tone. We cannot learn too much about someone from one or two line quotes. Jörg Hegel, the state is the divine idea as it exists on earth. The state is the reality of the moral idea, the moral spirit, the manifest will, self-evident, which thinks and knows itself. Like Fichte, Hegel is a disciple of Immanuel Kant. Now, Hegel's mission is to offer something concrete as far as an explanation of reality, incorporating past, present, and future.
Now, at first, this sounds promising, like, ooh, maybe we're going to get back on track here, like back towards reason. Nope. They talk about reason. They all talk about reason. But Hegel calls reality the absolute spirit. And his goal is to not only understand it and explain it, but to illustrate its development over time. Ironically, this reality was nothing concrete. For Hegel, it was the ideas. It was, as he would say it, the human mind and its ability to reason. But he's not talking about minds of people like you and me. He's talking about the minds of the rulers. He is the inventor of what Nietzsche later calls the Superman. So ordinary people, they suck. They're not really significant. That's all part of his philosophy. But what he is trying to do is illustrate how this absolute is constantly evolving. Now, this is the mind, okay? So he calls this process the dialectic. Hegel believed that reality was an absolute spirit and that history moved forward through constant acts of synthesis. Thesis meets its opposite, antithesis, and they combine into a synthesis, which then meets its own antithesis and makes a new synthesis, and so on and so on and so on. Now, on the surface, sure, a seemingly harmless historical observation. But at this point, folks, I think I need to evoke that all-important and timeless question that Austin Powers once asked so eloquently: who does number two work for? What Hegel has devised is a new and improved owner's manual for human civilization, whether he knows it or not, whether it was intentional or not. This Hegelian dialectic, which is often referred to as problem, reaction, solution, is a show I did about this as well. It's called Problem, Reaction, Solution. This is the manufacture of crisis, knowing that a properly conditioned population will have a very predictable response, and at that time, a so-called solution, very preferable, very desirable to those in power, whatever the situation, wherever the place, whatever the time, can be put forward. We've seen this again and again and again. We just talked about this in the last show, the Introduction to the Logical Fallacy series, where we're looking at the work of Edward Bernays. So, like, the government wants popular support for an action. Time and time again, the government calls on Bernays to create or exaggerate the crisis, to spin it in a way that gets the desired reaction so the already planned solution can be introduced to the public. We saw this with healthcare. We see this with warfare. It's no secret that the people who had power in the first decade of the 21st century in the executive branch of government, not George Bush, but all of the wire pullers in that administration, had wanted this kind of intervention in the Middle East since Jesus, the early eight. Well, it depends on who the enemy was, right? Because before, the interventions were about, were related to the Soviets. And even as far back as the middle of the Clinton administration, you have people urging him to invade Iraq, to occupy Iraq, to change regimes in Iraq. I'm off course. But this is, what I'm saying is, this is not conspiracy or unfounded. It is conspiracy. I'm sorry, but it's not like conspiracy theory. One of the most famous theoretical applications or aspirational applications of Hegel's dialectic is a book called The Communist Manifesto, written by Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. And did Hegel invent this concept of, you know, having some kind of desirable outcome so then you trick the masses into thinking that they wanted it? No, of course not. But it's an observation that he makes that's been going on in history for a long time, and he puts a new spin on it, right? It's not about power. It's about progress. And then people in power can tell themselves stories about progress, and you see where that goes. Hegel also embraces Kant's ethics of duty. He adds that social morality takes precedence over personal ethics. So in other words, what is desirable, what is ethical, is to conform to the demands of society. But that doesn't mean anything, right? Because that's just the concept of collectivism. Like, hey, we're all in this together. Look at us. What a team we are. What that really means is a bunch of people who are malleable and obedient to the will of those in power, the people that Hegel respected so much at the expense of all other people. Ordinary people don't matter. The playthings of history. I forget whether it was Hegel or Nietzsche who said that. But their deaths, their struggle, small price to pay for progress. So this is how the needs of society, the general will, very quickly, almost automatically, totally inevitably, is transformed into the will of those who hold power over the society. And to a very confused public, the output of Fichte's education system, the recipients of Kant's ideas about collective identity, shit, what's the difference between the two? I hope this provides just a little bit more context for those quotes that I read of Hegel a couple minutes ago, his feelings about the state. So now, whatever the state wills is not what the people will, even though we're going to call it the general will. It's the will of those in power. Well, what an attractive idea this became in the latter half of the 19th century, and certainly in the first half of the 20th century. Because believe it or not, before this, German idealism, especially after the Enlightenment, there was some constraint on state power because of natural law, even though at the time still a lot of people might have considered it to be divine law. But like the idea that the state can just manipulate reality at the will of its so-called rulers, that is berserk. I at this point, I want to recommend Larkin Rose's book, The Most Dangerous Superstition, because this is it, this argument from authority. Today, even though I'm not religious, a term like God-given rights is a cliche. People don't even know what that means or what at one time in history that meant to people. Most people have never even heard of the concepts of natural law or customary law. No, now it's positive law, the stuff that people calling themselves the state make up to benefit themselves is all that matters now. So the big mission with Georg Hegel is to get this understanding of reality defined as ideas within a human mind and that mind's capacity for reason. But that's not about ordinary people. No, because they are the pawns on the chessboards of the supermen, of the great minds, the visionaries. And to just conclude with Hegel, he's also like a huge fan of war. Because why not? If you look at the rest of this philosophy, who fights in wars? It's not the visionaries. It's not the leaders, the rulers. It's the pawns. He says something like, war is what is necessary to preserve the moral health of people. Now, if you just walk up to a stranger and say, there was this philosopher, his name was Georg Hegel, and he said that war is good because it preserves the moral health of people. If you said that to any even slightly rational, non-psychopathic person who had never heard of Hegel, they would probably say, well, I'm sure he never amounted to much because that's insanity. That's very dangerous kind of thinking. But on the other hand, if I went up to this stranger and told them about all other aspects of Hegel's philosophy, the idea of the general will, the primacy of the state, the Superman, even though he didn't use that word, the relegation of ordinary people to meaningless, insignificant parts of society that are lucky enough to be graced with the presence of great minds, no matter what the cost in blood or even lesser inconvenience. His idea of ethics, collectivism. If I explained all these other things and then asked that stranger to make an inference about Hegel's feelings on war, if they were even just paying attention a little bit, they could probably come to that conclusion on their own. It fits perfectly within the rest of the philosophy. And this brings us to the latter half of the 1800s, to Friedrich Wilhelm Nietzsche. And this poor guy, I mean that. I mean, he, towards the end of his life, is mentally ill, and a lot of his ideas, as he conceived them, were not nearly as malevolent as their practical application in the 20th century. Nietzsche's ideas are similar to Hitler's ideas in that, at this point, after 100 years of bad philosophy, they're just crowd surfing into the 20th century, carried by the hands of a miseducated, confused, mystic death cult. To me, Nietzsche's philosophy seems to be largely observational. And this could have been true with Hegel as well. But what is interpreted later by people like Hitler, by people like Mussolini, as this call for their kind of despotism and tyranny, it was actually Nietzsche's evaluation of the world in which he lived. But I don't think that that's what Nietzsche set out to do. And I think, like, if we had this sort of hypothetical reunion, 21st century reunion of 19th century German thought, where all these people could come to the present day and look back over the last 100 years and see the results, I think Nietzsche, among all those people, would be the most horrified. Hegel would be like, yeah, more kind of, yeah. Kant would say, yeah, but think about my intentions, you know? I was trying to do the right thing. And Fichte would be like, nice. Exactly. Nailed it. That's my assessment. I want to be clear. It's my assessment. But, you know, of all these guys, I have a softer spot for Friedrich Nietzsche than the rest of them. And I think that as Nietzsche's looking at the world that he lives in, of course this is his conclusion, because he's observing Central Europe in the latter half of the 1800s. So we've got the Prussian schools in effect, we've got Otto von Bismarck's unification efforts of Germany in effect, we have this infection of Hegel's thinking, Kant's thinking, Fichte's thinking, all going on at this time. So yeah, I mean, he looks at ordinary people, he says they're sheep, they're herd, they're the unwashed masses. And he's also very critical of the kind of collectivist doctrinaire thinking that leads to what he calls a slave morality. He's very critical of Judeo-Christian traditions for that reason. So my understanding is that this whole Superman idea is not for Hitler. It's not for Mussolini. It's for you and me. We could all do this. We could all rise above and get a greater sense of personal power. We could reach our potential. Now, he was weird about this, though. And they're all kind of vague. Or maybe it's hard for me. I mean, like, I think I'm smart, but there's obviously some limitations to what I can understand in trying to see these people in the context of their times and what they're really trying to say and what their observations were. But he's kind of all over the place. When he's giving examples of this, he says, Jesus? Okay, well, sure. If that was a real guy, yeah. That would be an example of somebody who, you know, even though it didn't end well, kind of rose above a bad situation and took ownership, took personal control, Socrates, if you look at the obstacles that he faced within his society when he started speaking out and asking questions, Napoleon, too, one of these things is not like the others. But it seems like this was meant to be, unlike so many of the others, a philosophy potentially of personal empowerment for people who were stuck at that time in that herd. If you have a different interpretation, Facebook, put it there. I want to talk about this stuff, and I want to make sure that people are happy with my assessments and my explanations. But Nietzsche is the perfect time. Talking about Nietzsche is the perfect time for a transition within this show. And so just one caveat before we move on. Yeah, vagary can be dangerous, because in Nietzsche's body of work, we can see some seeds for what ultimately grew into objectivism, Ayn Rand's philosophy, you know, this mastery of the self, living for yourself, that altruism is not a virtue, to sacrifice yourself for the needs of others. You cannot live at anyone else's expense, and no one should expect that they can live at yours. But we also see the seeds of things like Nazism, if properly perverted. We see the seeds, even though this idea probably existed in Nietzsche's time, of eugenics. You know, like, don't have compassion for the weak. You know, they don't deserve to live. And here comes our transition. Philosophy by itself is relatively impotent, in my opinion, as far as the effect that it can have in the real physical world. And the path from the writing of Nietzsche to the action of the Nazis shows us this important next step of taking philosophy and combining it with psychology. And in this case, specifically, the psychology of power, the psychology of cultural, intellectual, financial elitism. And we talked about this in recent shows. People, you talk about this stuff and people say conspiracy. No one, that couldn't be anyone's thinking process. And I said, imagine yourself with a pest problem. And then I think you can understand a little bit more about what the mindset of some of these people who are so different than me and you, how they actually think. So when we take these philosophies that by themselves have no real power in the world, when we combine them with the psychology of power, and I think it's important to point out that we might not just be talking about a select few, a tiny group of people who think this way. Because as we've seen from studies like the Stanford Prison Experiments, power can corrupt people very, very quickly. And one of the things that is more absent from this show than it should be, what was the treatment of children like? By not just in, I mean, we understand what it was on a societal level if we look at the school system, right? If we look at, I know I haven't gotten to this yet, but how people like Otto von Bismarck organized them in a way to turn them into this collectively, this fighting machine later on. But how are children treated by their parents? And because I lack expertise on this subject, I would certainly, I think it would be irresponsible for me not to mention this, I would certainly refer you to the work of people like Lloyd Dumas, or specifically Lloyd Dumas, who's done excellent work on this subject. You can check the show notes for some of his links. His site is called Psychohistory. And, you know, he has talked about how when he was studying history, he always wanted to explore these subjects that he saw as root causes. And professors would tell them that you can't look at those things. You can't look at the foundation that all of this stuff is built on. Oh, because that would be so dangerous, wouldn't it? In our schools, when we were learning about things like World War II, you got to talk about Hitler, right? You have to talk about the economy in the Weimar Republic. You can't get any deeper than that. Because if you start explaining the popular ideologies in that society at that time to students, well, any
even relatively thoughtful young person would say something like, but that's exactly how we think now. So you can't do that. But I think we have to acknowledge that that foundation is there, and it's not just coming entirely from the schools. Even though these children are pumped out as incredibly obedient, conformist, intellectually apathetic, it takes more than that. Because there's no propaganda campaign that's sophisticated enough, in my opinion, that can take a person who had a supportive, nurturing, loving, non-abusive childhood and transform them into somebody who will just hate a group of people because they are that group of people. No way. I don't see how that could happen. Maybe there could be traumas later in life that could result in something like that, that kind of thinking. But I think this goes back to the beginning. You know, this goes back to the roots. All of that hatred, that angst, that aggression, that repressed childhood trauma already has to be there. And it's just like, hey, I've got all of this. Show me where to point it. And tragically, in the modern world, there have been several groups of people who, as individuals, I would say, they're probably dealing with these same kinds of traumas, who are ready, willing, and all too eager to show us where to point it. They say, sure, take all of that trauma that shows up in your adult life as these fantasies about justifiable aggression. Point it at black people. Point it at women. Point it at children. Point it at Germans. Point it at Jews. Point it at the Soviet Union. Point it at Korea. Point it at Vietnam. Pointed at Iraq, pointed at Iran, pointed at Mexicans, pointed at people who work on Wall Street, pointed at people who occupy Wall Street. But don't you dare point it at us. Oh, and by the way, all of their sickness, all of their trauma, all of their fantasies about justifiable aggression, well, it's pointed at you and me. Because for so long, people who are a lot like us, who surrendered autonomy and reason, have been making it so damn easy. To be continued.